Lecture 19. Greece Triumphs. The End of the Persian Wars.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. The Spartan bravery at Thermopylae, as we said in our last lecture, became a morale boost for the Greeks, even though the Persians were victorious. But the battle also showed that without the chance to deploy cavalry, the Persian army was severely hampered. And that gave the Greek hoplite soldier an advantage over the Persian soldier. After all, the Persians won victory at Thermopylae only when the road behind the Greeks was betrayed to them. That gave the Greeks a bit of heart. But even better for them was the news Themistocles would deliver that cut short any rejoicing on the Persian part. He'd defeated the Persians off Artemisium. In this lecture, we're going to look at the major Persian defeats at Greek hands at the battles of Salamis and Plataea. But we must also make mention of Artemisium, because that really helps to set up Salamis. And so I begin with that battle, with Artemisium. It seems that as part of their strategy to take Thermopylae, the Persians intended to land troops behind the Greek line, so as to cut it off front and rear. That made sense, given the Greek line was holding fast, and Thermopylae was a hard pass to breach. To achieve this, the Persian fleet had to sail down to Euboea, that long island off the eastern coastline of central Greece, and then sail into the narrow straits that separated the island from the mainland. Themistocles had stationed the Greek fleet off Artemisium to the island's north, so as to block the Persian fleet. And as the Persians sailed into view, he prepared to do battle. In a series of naval engagements fought over 2 days, so there wasn't just one battle of Artemisium, technically there were two, Themistocles defeated the Persian fleet. Now this was quite a feat, as the Persian ships far outnumbered the Athenian ones, and the Persians fought hard. But Themistocles was able to maneuver his trireme successfully in the narrow straits, whereas the heavier Persian vessels moved more slowly and with greater difficulty. This did not quite make them sitting ducks, but close to it. The Athenian trireme's ramming tactics wreaked havoc with the Persian navy, and to make matters worse, many of the Persians on board couldn't swim. So as their ships sank, they drowned. Persian demoralization must have been great, especially after the drawn-out engagement at Thermopylae. The Persians knew that they'd won there, that they'd won at Thermopylae, only because of their overwhelming numbers and, crucially, because of the betrayal of the road around Leonidas and his troops. Those were the only two reasons they won. When the Persians couldn't land their men from their ships at Thermopylae, the remainder of the Persian fleet from the battle pulled away and made its way down Euboea's eastern coastline, headed for Salamis. This is an island off the western coast of Attica. Salamis was within easy reach of the Isthmus of Corinth, which was the gateway between Attica and the Peloponnese. And it was at Salamis that the Greeks were assembling after Thermopylae. However, the Persian ships ran into some rough weather on the trip down to Salamis, and a large number of them sank. Now we need to remember that we're in an age where ships don't have stabilizers or anything like that that help them cope with bad weather or heavy swells, that sort of thing. Ships at this time didn't usually sail at night, mainly because they had no running lights or radar. So unless the stars were out, it was impossible to navigate and highly dangerous to sail. When ships did sail at nighttime, it was for an extraordinary reason. That's why ancient ships tended to hug coastlines, so that at dusk they could put into ports and stay there until dawn. So even mild bad weather that today might make a modern ship lurch and roll a little bit could be a disaster for a Greek ship. And the weather off Euboea was disastrous for the Persians. To make matters worse, Xerxes' lines of communication were anchored in his fleet. No pun intended, I had to slip that one in. And because of the loss of ships at Artemisium and off Euboea, his lines of communication were hugely disrupted. And this also greatly affected Persian morale. Nevertheless, once the Persians took Thermopylae, they were in central Greece. The next line of defence for the Greeks lay in the Isthmus of Corinth, and it was to Salamis that they collected, as I said, the same place as the Persian fleet was making its way to. We're still in the year 480, by the way. There's an awful lot happening in this year. Now, at Salamis, the Greeks debated what to do about their situation. And while they were doing so, Herodotus says that they saw the smoke from a burning Athens. Before Thermopylae, the Athenians had evacuated their city. They'd moved the people to the island of Salamis and to Troezen in the Peloponnese. This was probably at the instigation of Themistocles, who was hedging all bets. This move meant that once the Persians took Thermopylae, they had an easy route through Boeotia, which had Medes, remember, and then into Attica and to Athens itself, and the city was largely deserted. So the Persians laid waste to Attica, and then they entered the city of Athens itself. They destroyed the city's fortification walls. They looted and ransacked the place, and they burned the Acropolis. In the process, they seized many works of art that they shipped back to Persia. Among these works of art was the famous statue of Harmodius and Aristogiton, the so-called tyrant slayers who had assassinated Hipparchus the tyrant in 514 BC. This statue and other stolen artworks were later found by Alexander the Great in one of the rooms of the Persian palace at Susa in 331 BC. And we'll probably revisit this when we deal with Alexander. By the way, he sent the statues back to Greece. The news that Athens had been taken, and actually seeing the smoke as the Persians burned it, caused despair among the Greeks at Salamis. Many there wanted to leave immediately to return to their homes to defend them, expecting, logically, that the Persians would attack them next. Now, this is normal human behaviour. If you know your family or your home is in danger, you want to go to its defence straight away. Even Eurybiades, the Spartan commander of the Greek forces, was in favour of pulling back to the Isthmus to defend it against the Persians, so that they might not enter the Peloponnese and so attack Sparta. This move meant that the Greeks were quite prepared to leave Athens to suffer as the Persians saw fit. So there was no move to say, let's relieve Athens. Everyone was thinking of their own homes. Themistocles realized that if the Greeks headed off to their respective homes, they wouldn't merely split up the Greek force, but their action would allow the Persians the means, and easy means at that, to pick off one state at a time until all of Greece was lost to Persia. This is a bit like the Roman strategy of divide and conquer. Don't take on all the enemy at once, pick off individual states or enemies at a time, and eventually you'll conquer the whole lot. A united front was always the best, and Themistocles saw that. Artemisium had shown the value of naval warfare, and the Persian fleet was now in disarray thanks to its disastrous voyage down past Euboea. Themistocles knew that it was vital for the Greek force to stay together, and he also wanted to force another naval battle against Persia, knowing that the next battle was likely to affect the progress of the Persian land force that was now in Attica. Potentially even the next battle, if fought at sea, would tip the scales in favour of the Greeks, given the reliance of the Persians on their navy. But how could he do this before everyone left, before the Greeks scattered at the isthmus to their various homes? Well, according to Herodotus, Themistocles wrote a letter that he arranged to fall into Xerxes' hands. This letter apparently said that the Greeks were confused about what to do next, that the Greek force was splitting up, and that its fleet was leaving the next day, probably at dawn. That, said Themistocles, would be the time to attack it. The letter turned out to be a hoax, but Xerxes fell for it, and he immediately ordered the Persian fleet into the mouth of the Bay of Salamis. His idea was to surprise the Greek fleet before it was supposed to set sail the next morning. Whether Herodotus is accurate in how he presents the influence of Themistocles over the likes of Eurybiades, or whether even Herodotus is accurate in what he says about the contents of the letter, is unknown. Herodotus travelled around the Greek world, reciting accounts of other places and customs, different peoples. And that's how he made his living, out of being a travelling storyteller. We don't have these so much in the West, but they still exist in the East. In Iran, for example, we have storytellers that do the rounds, village to village, town to town, telling the story of Alexander the Great. We'll revisit them when we get to Alexander in this course. But Herodotus was not averse to wealthy people offering him money to elevate their role in political or military affairs. In other words, for him to make what they did better than it actually was, or even have them do something that they didn't in real life. So Herodotus' account of Themistocles' engineering of the Battle of Salamis and his role in that battle, Herodotus could easily be relying on a pro-Themistoclean family tradition, because biting the hand that feeds you is not a good thing. People will give Herodotus money, but if he doesn't do what they want him to do, they'll stop giving him that money, and he's reliant on money for livelihood. Another instance of Herodotus's manipulation of material, or in this case his selectivity, is his treatment of the queen of Halicarnassus, a lady by the name of Artemisia. She was some sort of counselor to Xerxes. According to Herodotus, she told Xerxes not to order his fleet against the Greek one at Salamis, but he ignored her. He should have listened to her, as events proved. This is why I think Herodotus makes a meal out of her advice, because he, like her, was from Halicarnassus. And this is a nice bit of pushing the hometown forward here in his account of the Persian Wars. If Artemisia had come from somewhere else, he might not even have mentioned this incident. Xerxes' fleet meant the Greeks had no choice but to stand and fight now. But Themistocles was ready for the Persians. He'd anticipated all of this. Behind the bay at Salamis, there was a narrow channel. Themistocles hid the bulk of his fleet in that channel. When the Persians sailed into the Bay of Salamis, they saw only a few Greek ships there, and they thought that the fleet was already scattering. Some of them must have escaped during the night. At that point, with the Persians in the bay, and it's a fairly narrow bay, Themistocles gave the order to attack. His ships came out of the channel, and they rammed the Persian vessels broadside. I imagine those bronze hooks on the prow of a trireme smashing into the wood of a Persian vessel, broadside. As at Artemisium, these heavier Persian ships were unable to manoeuvre as quickly and effectively in the straits at Salamis as the Greek vessels could manoeuvre. The Persian vessels were so big, and there were so many of them, that they really were sitting ducks this time. And as the Persian ships scrambled to manoeuvre, tried to turn around to face Themistocles' fleet, a number of Persian ships ran into each other and that just added to the chaos and confusion. Xerxes now realized that he had been duped by Themistocles' letter. Finally, it hits home. But it was too late. As the Persian ships were holed, they quickly sank. And to make matters worse, the Persians hadn't learned to swim since Artemisium, so again a great many of them drowned. All in all, some 200 Persian ships were destroyed at the Battle of Salamis. And regardless of any propaganda on Herodotus's part, Salamis was very much the victory of Themistocles and the Athenian navy. In fact, Salamis was a turning point in the Persian Wars. Xerxes realized it, as his action after the battle indicates. He saw the whole thing because he was sitting on his throne on a promontory on the opposite coast, watching how the battle unfolded. He wouldn't have been very happy, obviously, but what he did next confounded everyone. He went home. Actually, he made for his palace at Sardis in the western part of the Persian Empire. He first ordered the execution of the Phoenician captains. Phoenician fleet was an ally of the Persians. The Phoenician captains in his fleet were executed, accusing them of cowardice and that they cost him the battle. But this, of course, was just a face-saving gesture. And then, along with the remnants of his fleet, and it really was in tatters by then, Xerxes returned to Persia. He left behind his general Mardonius in charge of the Persian land force. Now, if the outcome of the Battle of Salamis wasn't bad enough for the Persians, what must that land army have thought as news leaked to it that the king had fled and basically ditched his men? Talk about a demoralizing effect on the troops. And this, of course, would neatly play into the Greek hands. What do we make of Xerxes' actions? Isn't the general supposed to stick it out with his men and not flee and leave his troops behind? Isn't the captain supposed to go down with the ship? Mardonius was a skilled general, but he was not the great king. Moreover, winter was fast approaching, and the worsening weather conditions would be a cause of further problems for the Persians that were left in Greece. Rather than stake everything on a pitched battle there and then, Mardonius thought it prudent, and he was right to do so, to retreat north for the winter, to give himself time to regroup and think about what to do next. And so, he successfully led his Persian troops out of central Greece and north to Medes, Thessaly. And he was helped immensely in this by the Greeks not following up their victory at Salamis by attacking him at the same time. We'll talk about why they didn't do this in a moment. Mardonius would return to do battle in the following spring. But in the meantime, the Greek fleet, or more likely a portion of it, set off in pursuit of Xerxes and the remains of the Persian fleet. And we'll find out what happened when they caught up to it in a little while. With the Persians in such disarray after Salamis, we might expect the Greeks to take advantage of this and march immediately to finish them off. For some reason, they didn't, and so they let slip what must have been a golden opportunity, because Mardonius was able to escape north for the winter. He was able to regroup, and he was able to bring the Greeks to battle again the following year. Why didn't the Greeks follow up their victory? The answer is simple. We don't know. Since military campaigns were not usually waged in winter, this may have been a deciding factor. But then again, the Spartans alone of the Greek states trained and fought in the winter. That's another thing that made them different from other Greek armies, who only trained and fought during the campaigning season, spring to the onset of winter. The Spartans were hardy annuals. So taking Mardonius on at this time, as winter was approaching, would not have fazed the Spartan army. But perhaps the real reason lies more with possible quarrels amongst the allies, especially in view of the role that Themistocles had played in forcing the Greeks to do battle at Salamis. What he'd done was a gamble. What if the Greeks had lost? Themistocles had also gone against the decision of Eurybiades, who was the elected commander-in-chief. Remember, back at the Greek Congress in 481, the Athenians had climbed down and the Spartans had been elected supreme commanders of land and naval forces. Eurybiades then had said, "We'll scatter." Themistocles, in effect, ignored that order. What he did was almost tantamount to mutiny. Themistocles' action then would not have sat well with Eurybiades, and it certainly wouldn't have sat well with the Spartans. Even less so now, given the outcome of Salamis and who was responsible for that battle. Thermopylae was a stirring example of Spartan honour and resolve. There's no question about that. But the Athenians had now defeated the Persians twice. Once on land at Marathon in 490, and now at sea at Salamis in 480. And this wasn't a minor skirmish at sea either. It had forced the great king out of Greece. It was a turning point in the war. The Spartans would have had their noses put well out of joint again, and they may well have resisted taking on Mardonius at this time as a means of exerting their authority over the Athenians. If this is true, if the Spartans, perhaps deliberately is too strong a word, but if the Spartans allowed Mardonius to get away because they felt they needed to reassert their authority in some way over the Athenians, then it's another example of Spartan selfishness, for want of a better word, and it's an excellent example of how tensions continue to run high between Athens and Sparta. It's no surprise that these two states will soon be at war with each other. Whatever the real reason for letting Mardonius escape north, whatever the real reasons, plural, there was still a Persian army on Greek soil, and hence there was still a major threat to Greek security. There was also the chance that Xerxes might return, bringing with him even more troops. After all, he'd fled to Sardis, and from there it was an easy run back to the Hellespont for a return trip to Greece. So that winter of 480-479 couldn't have been an easy one for the Greeks. Anyway, in the spring of 479, that's the opening of the campaigning season, Mardonius sent his ally, Alexander the King of Macedonia, to Athens. Now, this is not Alexander the Great, who hails from the later 4th century. This is an earlier Alexander. Now, this Alexander told the Athenians that Mardonius promised to let bygones be bygones, and he requested that Athens ally with Persia. This was to be a separate peace between Athens and Persia. It was not going to be any part of any common Greek peace one. And it's very interesting that Mardonius signaled the Athenians out in this way. Presumably, it was because of their navy. Something, remember, the Spartans didn't have. Now, Mardonius's offer, anyway, was a significant climb down on the part of Persia, given the aims of Xerxes. Remember, he wanted to come in and conquer all of Greece. According to Herodotus, there was an embassy from Sparta present in Athens, and these ambassadors would have spoken at the assembly, which debated Mardonius's offer, presumably urging the Athenians not to accept it. In practical terms, Athens would be seen as Medizing, and it's no surprise that the assembly did reject Mardonius's offer. And so, as a result, Mardonius now has no choice but to march against the Greeks. Given the non-existence, to all intents and purposes, of the Persian fleet, the fate of Greece would be decided at one final battle, and it would be a land one. Mardonius marched into Attica via Thebes, which had earlier Medized. He picked up a Theban contingent of troops along the way to fight with him. The Athenians had evacuated Attica again, So when Mardonius approached it, he found it largely deserted one more time. Hence, in the spring or perhaps even early summer of 479, Mardonius secures Attica again. His action was in response to the Athenians' rejection of his peace overtures. Now, at this point, when Mardonius has again taken Attica, the Athenians urgently sent for help to Sparta. They even said, Herodotus tells us, that if the Spartans refused to help them this time, they would withdraw from the war. Evidently, the Athenians remembered their plight before Marathon when Sparta refused to commit troops. Well, this time the Athenians were using the threat of Medizing if Sparta didn't comply. And it did the trick. A Spartan army of 5,000 hoplites, each soldier supplemented by 7 helots, marched out to help Athens. This ratio, by the way, of 7 helots to each Spartan hoplite gives us some idea of the ratio of helots generally to Spartans. Presumably the Spartans didn't bring every helot with them, so perhaps we have 10, 11, 12 or so helots for every Spartan citizen. When Mardonius heard of the Spartan army marching into Boeotia, he moved back into Boeotia as well. And at Plataea, on the border between Attica and Boeotia, the armies of the Greeks and the Persians faced off. Herodotus tells us that the Persian army numbered 330,000, but that figure is impossibly high. He also tells us that only 3,000 of it survived, and that the losses on the Allied side amounted to only 159. Again, we have to take these figures with a huge pinch of salt. The Greek army was commanded by Pausanias, the nephew of Leonidas, and actually the regent of Leonidas' young son. He arranged the Greek line high above the plain of Plataea, and its position was essentially a defensive one. The two sides for a few days engaged in some minor skirmishes and sallies, presumably just to check each other out. Finally, Mardonius knew that these stalling tactics had to stop, and so he gave the order and attacked the Greek hoplite line face on. The battle was hard fought. It was a typical hoplite one. Tough fighting, casualties, nasty. But victory went to the Greeks. The Spartans played a conspicuous role in it because of their bravery and because of their planning. In the fighting at Plataea, Mardonius was killed, yet another blow to Persia. And the Theban Sacred Band, an elite infantry corps, was also decimated. Now, although the Persians fled from the battlefield, there was not going to be the opportunity to regroup this time as after Salamis. Mardonius's sword, by the way, was displayed on the Acropolis in Athens. That's a nice touch because the symbolism is obvious. Somebody might loot and burn Athens, but eventually that someone would be brought down. The victory at Plataea was a complement to that at Salamis, and Plataea was the end of the Persian wars on Greek soil. But it wasn't the end of that conflict. News reached Greece around the time of the battle, on the same day according to Herodotus, that the Greek fleet that had pursued the Persians after Salamis caught up with the Persians at Mycale, off the coast of Ionia, and defeated them in battle. The outcome of this battle was hardly a surprise to Herodotus, who says that the Greeks couldn't lose the Persian wars because of divine intervention on their side. He believed Xerxes was fated to lose because of his arrogance. He'd angered the gods. He'd crossed the line as a mortal man, and the gods were going to reward his arrogance with his defeat. This is a nice instance of Herodotus' belief in supernatural explanations. And actually, it's a topic I want to return to in our next lecture, Xerxes' arrogance, that is. And talking of that, our next lecture, we're going to conclude our analysis of the Persian Wars. And along the way, we're going to ask some questions about them and about their repercussions for relations between Athens and Sparta. we'll then be at the end of the archaic period. As I said before, the Persian Wars are the door to the classical period, and they also form the backdrop to the rise of Athenian imperialism in the 5th century. But before we dive into the classical period, I want to talk more about how and why I see the Persian Wars as this transition period between archaic and classical. And I want to do this because I think these wars give us a glimpse into how the Greeks, not just us, saw them as well. Thank you very much.